You are listening to a sermon by Mike Yankowski, recorded on Sunday, September 16th, 2012, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, good morning to all of you, and thank you so much for the chance to be here today. It's a great honor. It's also a little bit of a jarring experience to be here this morning, and I mean that in the best sense. I've been on sabbatical for the last 4 months, post-regent, so this is the very first opportunity I've had the chance to speak since I entered into sabbatical. So thank you for inviting me back out of it, and it's an honor to be here with you for this. To start this morning, what I want to do is to look at two different passages of Scripture in addition to the constellation of Scriptures that we've already been looking at about what it means for us to respond to those who are in need in our midst. And we're going to be building on a couple of core concepts. The first is this idea of shalom. Now, that's a term that will be familiar to some of you and perhaps not to others of you. Shalom is a Hebrew word that is often translated into English as peace. We sang this morning that we are people of God's peace. Peace in the New Testament, in the Greek language, is eirene, the Greek word eirene, which is a translation or the same concept as the Hebrew word shalom. But shalom is much more than just peace. Shalom is more accurately translated as flourishing, as fullness, as fulfillment. Theologian and philosopher Nicholas Wolterstorff captures shalom this way. He says, not only is shalom God's cause in the world, but all who believe in Jesus will, along with him, engage in the works of shalom. Shalom is both God's cause in the world and our human calling, even though the full incursion of shalom into our history will be divine gift and not merely human achievement. It is shalom that we are to work and to struggle for. We are not to stand around with hands folded, waiting for shalom to arrive. Rather, we are workers in God's cause. The Missio Dei is our mission too. I bring this up as a reminder for us from 2 weeks ago when Rosie preached on the text from Matthew chapter 5, the Beatitudes, and particularly Matthew chapter 5, verse 9, when Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Blessed are the shalom makers, for they shall be called children of God. Now, a couple of years ago, I had the chance to spend 5 months living as a homeless person on the streets of 6 different American cities. This was an intentional decision. My friend Sam and I decided to become homeless. We grew out our hair, grew out our beards, and entered into the homeless community in 6 different American cities. We lived as homeless men in Denver, in Washington, D.C., in Portland, Oregon, in San Francisco, in Phoenix, and in San Diego. So for 5 months, we lived on the streets. We slept underneath the bridges. We slept in the rain. We ate out of garbage cans. We panhandled, playing the guitars on street corners in order to make enough money to try and survive. This idea started in the middle of a church service, in which the primary text was the parable of the Good Samaritan. Now, at this time, I was a college student in California. I was attending a small Christian school called Westmont College. I was studying New Testament there. I was in a lot of theology classes, etc. And one of the very first assignments that I had to do in my New Testament class, my first term at Westmont, was to write a paper on the parable of the Good Samaritan. So I researched it. I read a lot of books about it. I understood what Jesus was on about. We're all familiar with this story, right? This is the story that Jesus tells in response to the lawyer's question, who is my neighbor? I need to love my neighbor as myself. Who is my neighbor? The lawyer steps forward and asks Jesus this question, and Jesus says, well, let me tell you a story about a man who's on a road from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he gets jumped by robbers. The robbers beat him and leave him half dead on the side of the road. And then 3 people come along. The first is the priest. The second is the Levites, who both pass by on the other side of the road. The third is a Samaritan who chooses to stop, acknowledge the need, see the person who's there, and then respond. Jesus tells the story and then looks back to the lawyer and says, which of these 3 was a neighbor to the one who fell among the robbers? The answer is obvious. The one who showed him mercy, the one who stopped, the one who responded. So I wrote a paper on this and I understood what Jesus was on about. I understood it. I can explain it. But then I'm sitting in this church service in Santa Barbara, and the pastor stands up and says, we're going to preach today. We're going to look today at the parable of the Good Samaritan. So he says, as I read this, I'd like for you to consider who you are in this parable. If this is a typology, if these are categories of people, who are you in this text? Are you the priest of the Levite who's so preoccupied perhaps with what you're going to do somewhere else that you miss the opportunities that are right in front of you? Are you the Samaritan who's willing to stop and respond? Maybe you're the person on the side of the road who's kind of been beat up right now and you're in need of compassion and someone's kindness and response. Who are you in this parable? That's the framing question. So he reads the parable, and as he's reading the parable, what comes to mind is what happened the previous night. I'd been downtown Santa Barbara with a couple of my friends. We'd gone to dinner and to a movie, and as we're walking from the movie theater back to our parking lot to get into our car to drive back up the hill to our comfortable Christian college campus, we passed two homeless guys. And as we pass them by, what I do is I turn to my friend on my right and I crack a joke. Not about the two people sitting on the sidewalk, but just a joke in general. Because what I'm thinking to myself is, if I can convince these two people that they don't exist, then I don't have to respond. So I look at my friend, we crack a joke, we laugh, we walk right on by. It worked beautifully. I didn't have to stop, I didn't have to respond, I didn't have to engage. For all practical purposes, they didn't exist. They weren't there. But then I'm sitting in a church service the next morning, and the pastor's saying, who are you in this typology? Who are you in this parable? How do you respond? Well, that's when it kind of hit me between the eyes, because here I am acing New Testament papers on the parable of the Good Samaritan, and when it comes right down to actually choosing to stop and to respond to people, I pretend like they don't even exist. In the middle of that church service came this idea, this flash of an image, if you will, to try and enter into that life, to try and see what it's like from the inside to be someone who's at the mercy of others. To be someone who's sitting on the streets looking up, hoping that they might actually be able to get enough food that day. Or wondering where they're going to sleep that night. Or wondering how they're going to stay dry. Or waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning when all the public facilities and public buildings are closed with a stomach ache and wondering, where am I going to go to the bathroom? Those are the kinds of questions that began that day. It was 16 months from when that idea first started to when my friend Sam and I began living on the streets. It was 16 months of planning, prayer, preparation, volunteering in a local rescue mission, asking questions of a board of directors, theology professors, pastors, rescue mission presidents, etc., who sort of helped to give us guidance and wisdom in this whole process. 16 months of preparation. And then Sam and I started on the streets. The very first city we were on the streets in was Washington, D.C. And I'll never forget that very first day, because we had a friend drop us off right outside of Union Station, and as they dropped us off outside of Union Station, we got out of our car, their car, and went to the trunk, opened up the trunk, and grabbed the stuff that we had, that we were going to have for the next 5 months. I had one pair of shorts, one pair of jeans, a t-shirt, a sweatshirt, a backpack with a few books, a Bible, some journals in it, a guitar with which to panhandle, and a sleeping bag that I picked up for $2 at a local thrift store. That's all Sam and I had. He had more or less the same amount of stuff. And we look at each other and slam the trunk and watch the car drive away. And Sam's eyes were about this big at that point. And I'm pretty sure mine were too, because we're both thinking to ourselves, what are we doing? What are we doing? I mean, obviously this is artificial in one very real sense, right? Like, we always know that we can go back to our normal life. We know that we're going to return to college one day. We know that we're going to go home someday. And so it's artificial in that sense. There's a safety net. But I don't know where we're going to sleep tonight. We don't have any extra money. We don't have credit cards. We don't have cell phones. Most of the things we normally depend on, like a roof to keep us dry, or four walls to keep us safe, or a lock on the door to make us feel secure, or a credit card to buy food with, those things we don't have anymore. How are we supposed to survive? Where do we go? What do we do? We walked into Union Station downstairs into the food court. This is the big station where all the trains and subways come together in downtown Washington, D.C. We walked downstairs to the food court and sat down at a table and journaled about how strange it was to be two 20-year-old guys, always hungry without any means of getting some food, but in a room completely filled with food. In fact, with garbage cans overflowing with food. We were sitting right next to a mother and her toddler. And the toddler began to demand that he wanted to not eat the piece of pizza that his mother had purchased for him. He decided that particular day that he hated pepperoni. He despised it, as a matter of fact, and he was letting everybody know how much he hated pepperoni. I'm looking at Sam, and I said, I don't know about you, I love pepperoni pizza. Maybe we can ask her if we can have her son's pizza. Obviously, he doesn't want it. At that point, she got kind of embarrassed, and she stood up, and she grabbed her son by the hand and grabbed the piece of pizza by the hand, and they stormed out, and as she was walking out, she threw the piece of pizza away. And I looked at Sam, and I said, well, don't get me wrong, I love pepperoni pizza, right? Like, I love pepperoni pizza, but I don't love it that much. I'm not ready to dig into the trash of someone else's food Not yet, anyway, right? That was the first day. It was about 2 weeks of day in, day out, waking up on the street. 2 weeks, day in, day out, trying to figure out, where are we going to stay dry tonight? How are we going to get cool? It's 90 to 35 degrees, 90% humidity. Where are we going to get cool because we're dehydrated, because we're overheating? How are we going to survive? 2 weeks of day in, day out, sitting on the street, watching everybody who walks by, pretending like we don't even exist, that we didn't care anymore where the food was coming from. We were happy to dig into the garbage. We were happy to find someone else's trash in order to finish because we were hungry. It didn't matter. We didn't care. One of the biggest questions that Sam and I wanted to ask as we were on the streets is, how do Christians respond? Because this had started with me realizing that, gosh, I'm a theology student and I'm pretending like people don't exist. How do other men and women of faith respond? How do people who seek to follow Christ respond to us when we're in this place of need? Some people responded with great compassion, great kindness. There were several churches that invited us in, welcomed us with open arms, and said, hey, would you come and eat with us after? Would you come and feast with us? Is there anything we can do? A church in Phoenix provided groceries for us. They helped us get a bus ticket in order to get from Phoenix onto San Diego, where we were trying to get. They responded with enormous compassion and kindness. I wish that I could say that we always encounter that kind of compassion and kindness when we were on the streets. But unfortunately, that's not the case. One church that Sam and I were at in Phoenix, we stepped right outside of a very large church. This is a very, very large church. It's a church campus, not a church building. Several auxiliary buildings, a very large area. Sam and I stepped right outside of the front doors of this main sanctuary on a Friday evening. Saturday morning, we woke up as in one of the auxiliary buildings, a church breakfast was being set up. And Sam and I were watching these stainless steel buffet trays full of bacon and eggs and pancakes being carried into this auxiliary building. This is pretty exciting, right? I mean, we haven't eaten in a day and a half. We're on a church's property. Lo and behold, they're having a church breakfast. Maybe we might be invited in. I don't know. We're hopeful we might get some food. A couple of minutes later, these two gentlemen come walking across from that auxiliary building where the church breakfast was being set up towards Sam and I. And as they get closer to us, we can tell by their body language that they're really not very excited by the fact that we're there. As they get a little bit closer, one of the gentlemen calls out to us and says, guys, you're not supposed to be here right now. You need to get out of here. And we said, well, okay. But he then immediately walked right past us into the sanctuary. We didn't have a chance to talk about it. A couple of minutes later, the two guys came back out of the main sanctuary and saw Sam and I still sitting there because we're thinking to ourselves, hey, wait a minute. We're not going to go. Not yet. I mean, come on. Maybe after breakfast, sure. But not right now. Not right before breakfast. They come back out, see us still sitting there, and began to get a little bit frustrated. The same guy who called out to us before looked at us again and said, guys, you're not supposed to be here right now. I already told you that. What are you still doing here? And I said, well, yes, sir. You know, I heard that you said that we're not supposed to be here right now, but why? Why do we have to go? I don't understand. Why do we have to go? He thought about it for a minute and said, oh, well, because these are church grounds. This is a church campus. It's not for this. You need to leave. And I said, well, gosh, I probably shouldn't have done this, but, you know, I thought to myself, what do you know? I'm a theological student. I kind of like debate. Let's talk about that for a little while. Like, what are church grounds for? You know, I mean, maybe loving God, loving your neighbor. I don't know. Let's dialogue about that. He got really frustrated, understandably, at that point and said, you know what? We could stand here and debate that all day. Bottom line is, they're not for this. Leave. So we left. That was a Saturday morning. Sunday morning, we came back to the church service and we had gotten the service times wrong. We showed up about a half an hour early, and we came into this large, empty sanctuary and sat down, and over the next half an hour, the entire church filled up around us, except for this 10-foot radius right around us where nobody really wanted to sit. What we looked like is what we smelled like. People thought they knew who we were before they'd even asked. It's interesting to be in a room full of people gathered together for worship and to be alone because of what people think you are. But anyway, at the end of the service, we heard from the very back of this large sanctuary, this guy just yelling at the top of his lungs, and he's saying, guys, 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 and he runs across the back of the church, down the main aisle to the pews right behind us, and he comes up and he throws his arms around both of us in this big bear hug. This is totally taking Sam and I aback, right? Because we haven't been hugged in a long time. We do smell quite bad by this point in the journey. So we're completely astonished by this, and it's the guy who kicked us off the property the day before. And he's got tears streaming down his face, and he's saying, guys, I am so sorry. I can't believe I did that. I cannot believe I kicked you off the church's property during a church breakfast. I am sorry. Would you forgive me, please? And we said, yeah, sure, man. Of course, we forgive you. I mean, gosh, we've been on the streets for 4 months. By the time we've gotten here to Phoenix, we're used to it. It happens a lot. Don't worry about it. You're not the only one. We forgive you. It's okay. And he got up, chuckled at that, but said, gosh, you know, you shouldn't be used to it. If there's any place you should be loved and accepted exactly as you are, it's the church, because That's how it works. It's not fix yourself and then come. It's come and watch as God's Spirit transforms you. We chatted about that a little bit, and he got kind of embarrassed at that point and put his hands into his pockets and said, "Guys, I have to confess something to you." And here's why I'm sharing this story with you, because I think this idea of being shalom makers, this idea of being children of God, this idea of loving our neighbors as ourselves is deeply affected by this. What I mean is, at that point, he got embarrassed and said, I have to confess something to you guys. You're not going to believe this, and I'm not very happy about this, but I'm actually the director of homeless outreach for our church. So they were like, wait, what? wait a minute. So the director of the homeless outreach for the church kicked us off the church's property during a church breakfast. How does that work? I mean, explain that. So we chatted about that a little bit, and he said, well, yeah, it was kind of strange because, you know, our church's homeless ministry is on Tuesdays. Saturday mornings are church breakfast time. You want homeless ministry, come back on Tuesdays. The two don't mix, right? This kind of idea of nice, neat compartmentalization. We all do it. It's a product of how busy we are, how frenetic our lives are, how overwhelmed we are by the pace of things. So we have to compartmentalize, right, in order to just survive. I get that. I do that. I'm willing to bet you do that. But I want to suggest to you that being children of God, that being shalom makers, that being agents of reconciliation, ambassadors of Christ's kingdom, means being willing to uncompartmentalize our lives, being willing to allow God to interrupt us. I have a really good friend who says that if you read the Gospels, or as we read the Gospels, we see constantly Jesus is leading a ministry of interruptions. He's constantly being interrupted. He's going in one particular direction, and someone comes from a complete other direction, and he stops, he engages, he responds. He acknowledges them as an individual, as a human being created in God's image, and responds. Being children of God means being interruptible. Being shalom makers means being interruptible. Sam and I were panhandling. We'd sit on the street corners and open up our guitar cases and play and sing and just watch as people did or did not respond. As I mentioned, most people passed us by pretending like we weren't there, as I myself had done so many times before. But suddenly to be on the other side of that, to be on the receiving end of someone else's intentional ignorance, was astonishing. Sam and I in Washington, D.C., one evening, we took the advice of an elderly homeless man and homeless woman. They said, you know what, you guys? You should probably go out to Georgetown because there's more nightlife in Georgetown. It's a Friday night. Downtown Washington, D.C. is pretty dead. If you go out to Georgetown, though, there's a good nightlife. You'll probably do better. So we took their advice and walked the 3 miles from downtown D.C. out to Georgetown and found this beautiful spot right on the banks of the Potomac River. I mean, this is a gorgeous scene. I mean, picture this, right? It's June. It's summertime. The sun is setting over the banks of the Potomac. People are pulling up their very expensive, nice yachts, tying off. There's a big restaurant right behind us, 4-star. Lots of bars in the area, thousands of people walking around, lots of excitement and energy. People are dressed up to impress. This is the kind of scene that we find ourselves in. Sam and I sit right on the banks of the river, right on the boardwalk, open up our guitar cases and start singing and playing. Over the course of the next 4 hours, from 6 p.m. until 10 p.m., Sam and I have made $1.18. And we're looking at that and sort of realizing, well, we're probably not going to eat, at least not in Georgetown, on $1.18. Maybe we can sleep off the hunger tonight and go find a place tomorrow that serves a free breakfast or something like that. We're just about to finish our last song when all of a sudden this group of little boys comes running along the boardwalk. Now, these little boys are about as out of place as Sam and I are. They're all under the age of 10. And as they pass us, they look over and see us sitting on the street playing our guitars. And so they run up and completely surround us. They circle us. So Sam and I are sitting on the ground. Our guitar case is open. And this group of boys is in front of us, silhouetted against this large, expensive 4-star restaurant scene. And as we finish our song, the leader of this group of little boys, maybe 9 or 10 years old, steps forward and says, kind of nervous, you know, he's got his hands in his pockets. Excuse me, sirs. We are from the Boys and Girls Club of America, and we're raising money for our summer baseball uniforms. Would you like to help us? And so I looked from him to my guitar case and back. I said, sure. We have $1.18, but if you want it, go ahead and take it. It's yours. Go ahead. You got it. At that moment, from the back of this group of little boys, the youngest, smallest guy, and he's maybe 6 or 7, he's the littlest dude, steps forward, pushes his friends out of the way with his elbows, just moving them out of the way, comes up, stands right in front of me. And he looks me in the eyes, and I look at him, and he frowns and says, hey, wait a minute, you guys don't have any money at all, do you? You don't have anything. said, well, you know, I mean, $1.18. Other than that, not right now, no. He thought about it for a minute, put his hand into his pocket, pulled out $1.25, put it into the guitar case, looked back at me and said, don't worry about it, bro. I got you covered. No way. In this one moment, this little boy just gave us 7 more cents than all of the adults who passed by over the previous 4 hours. No way. Well, yeah, I mean, he gave us 7 more cents. But that's not the reason I'm sharing the story with you. The reason I'm sharing the story with you is that that moment, that one just 30-second conversation with that group of boys, that changed our whole evening. And you know what's most surprising to me about that? That group of little boys were the only people who were willing to stop and treat us like we were human beings that whole night. They're the only people who acknowledged us. They're the only people who saw us. They're the only people who were willing to treat us like we were actually people, not garbage. And that changed the whole day. It changed the whole evening. This is kind of a hard aspect to get at in all of this, but people who are marginalized, people who are on the fringes of society, people who are conditioned by other people's responses to them to believe that they don't matter, that they don't exist, that they have no importance. Simple, small things can make an astonishing difference. Being willing to look people in the eyes, treat them like they're human beings. Being willing to take the time to have a quick conversation with them. I've been thanked, explicitly thanked, for taking the time to say, how's it going today? Just that. And have someone say, thanks for talking to me. Here's what I mean. I was in Portland, Oregon not too long ago, and I was downtown in Oregon and had a couple of extra hours and a couple of extra dollars, and so I was walking around downtown Portland, and I saw this local burrito stand, right? These are not really nice burritos, but, you know, they're adequate burritos. It's a little street vendor selling bean and cheese burritos. $2.50 for a bean and cheese burrito, okay? So I went and I bought 10 of these bean and cheese burritos. I had $25 in my pocket. No tax, no sales tax in Oregon, right? So $25, 10 bean and cheese burritos, $2.50 a piece. I walked around for the next couple of hours, sitting down next to people and just kind of saying, hey, are you hungry? Do you want a burrito? Some people said no. Some people cussed me out. Some people said they hated bean and cheese burritos. They hated me. They didn't want to talk. No. Other people said, yeah, I'd love to have a conversation. Yeah, I'd love to have a burrito. Thanks, I haven't eaten in 2 days. One of these guys, halfway through his burrito, we're just chatting about anything and everything, you know? Talking about the weather, talking about sports, talking about baseball, basketball, football, soccer, talking about politics, talking about whatever. Anything just to get the conversation going. One of these guys, halfway through his burrito, stops me and says, Mike, do you realize you changed my week? I look down at one of those burritos and I'm thinking to myself, man, that must be pretty good. Maybe he's a really good burrito maker. And he said, no, it's not the burrito. I mean, that's good, thanks. But you're the first person who's talked to me in a week. Thank you. And I'm thinking to myself, really? 5 minutes of my day and $2.50 worth of bean and cheese burrito can have that kind of impact. It can change your week just by being willing to stop and to acknowledge someone's existence. Jesus led a ministry of interruptions. Constantly we see him stopping to interact with the person who's interrupted him. The blind beggar on the side of the road who's crying out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And everybody's trying to just get him to shut up. And Jesus stops, responds, asks them what they're desiring, and heals them. A willingness to be interrupted. A willingness to see people as people. These are some of the characteristics, I believe, deeply, of what it means to be a shalom maker. What it means to be a peacemaker. What it means to be a child of God. A couple of years ago, I had a chance to be at a rescue mission banquet. This is a fundraising banquet for the Newark Rescue Mission in Newark, New Jersey. And I was sitting at a table with a wonderful woman named Lucy. And over the course of the dinner, Lucy and I just were chatting. And I, you know, she's about 70, 75 years old. And I said, Lucy, tell me some of your story. You know, who are you? What has your life been like? You're 3 times as old as I am. You know, tell me about who you are. What's your life been like? And she said, well, do you really want to know? I said, yeah, I'd love to know. Please, tell me. So she said, well, if you really want to know, when I was 15, I became a prostitute. I said, I did not expect the story would start that way. Please continue. She said, yeah, from 15 to 25, I was a prostitute, and I sold myself every night in order to buy the drugs that I was addicted to. She said, but when I was 25, this elderly lady moved into an apartment on the street that I used to walk every night selling myself, and she was a Christian. She started reaching out to me and some of the other prostitutes, and she tried to care for us, tried to tell us that this is not what God wanted for us, that there was a way out, that if we work together, we might be able to find a better way for us to live. At first, this is Lucy telling me, she said, Mike, at first we stiff-armed her, we cussed her out, we told her we didn't believe in her, we didn't believe in God, we didn't care. And then Lucy said, but Mike, one night I got beat up pretty badly, and the guy threw me out of his car, and I'm lying on the cement, and I know my ribs are broken, and I've got a broken nose and two black eyes, and my eyes are so swollen, I can't even open them. I have no idea where I am. And then Lucy said, but Mike, I heard a door open up, and I heard someone's footsteps coming down the front steps, and then gentle hands lifting me up and carrying me inside. The guy had thrown Lucy out right in front of this elderly Christian woman's apartment. And instead of her faith being just an idea, instead of it just being a set of doctrinal beliefs, instead of it just being a statement, she put her faith into action, walked down the steps, picked Lucy up, brought her inside. Lucy's telling me this in the middle of this dinner at this banquet, right? I'm not paying attention to anything else that's going on in the room. I'm just focusing on Lucy and her story. She says, Mike, I laid there on this woman's couch for about a week. And this woman's active, tangible love, that's what brought me to God. She said, I didn't believe in God at that point, and I didn't care. But this woman saying, I'm loving you because Christ loves me and Christ loves you too, that opened my hardness to what God was doing. Long story short, Lucy gave her life to Christ, began this process of becoming a follower of Jesus, began following after Christ there on that woman's couch. Long story short, that woman was able to help Lucy kick her addiction to cocaine, was able to help her find a different place in the city to live, was able to find different employment. Long story short, that woman's active faith helped Lucy come to a brand new kind of life. Long story really short, Lucy said, Mike, a couple of years after this, I met this incredible guy named Howard. We got married. And then shortly after our wedding, we found out that that elderly Christian lady had passed away. We sensed God's calling to move back onto that street, into that same apartment, as a matter of fact. That's where we've lived for the past 40 years. She said, you know what's been amazing? I've been able to give the kind of love that I received from that woman that night for the past 40 years. She said, everybody in the neighborhood knows if you need anything at all, you can come to Lucy's. I said, what do you mean, Lucy? She said, well, if you get kicked out of your apartment and you need a place to crash, come on by, you can sleep on our couch. If you don't have enough food stamps, if you don't have enough money to buy food for you or your kids, come on by, we'll make a meal. We'll feast together. You get beat up, come on by. I have a first aid kit. I'll do my best to patch you up. I mean, you can imagine this woman saying these kinds of things, right? And then she said this. She said, I don't understand how it works, but it's like the more I try to care about others, the more alive I become. The fuller I am, the more I give away. I said, Lucy, that makes absolutely perfect sense. That's exactly what Jesus said in Mark chapter 8, verses 35 and 36. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and for the sake of the Gospels will find it. We live in a culture obsessed with, drunk on selfishness. The cultural mantra in our world, in the West, is please yourself. Work yourself into the ground for pleasure. And you might find happiness if you make it all the way to the top. And yet this inverted gospel that turns the kingdoms of the world upside down so that the King of Kings becomes the servant of all suggests the exact opposite. That the more we focus on others, the more we seek to love others as ourselves, or as Paul interprets Jesus' saying, that we consider others more significant than ourselves, then we come into the fullness of life which Christ came to bring. So what might that look like? To be shalom makers, to be peacemakers, to be children of God. Well, you've heard me alluding to this all the way along. It's a willingness to be interrupted. It's a willingness to see people as people. Now, I've been talking particularly about homelessness. I've been talking some about this experience that my friend Sam and I had. I've been talking some about how people's willingness to stop and acknowledge us changed the day. But I want to suggest that that's not unique to homelessness. That's not unique to poverty. I want to suggest that that is ubiquitous in our lives as people because we're always bumping up against people. I want to suggest that that ability, that opportunity, that invitation to be a child of God, to be a shalom maker, extends throughout all of our human relationships, so that it's the person on the bus on the way home today. It's the person that we're sitting next to in a cubicle tomorrow. It's the person that we're calling on the telephone halfway across the continent on Wednesday. It's always an opportunity to extend that kind of intentional acknowledgement, as opposed to intentional ignorance, towards another person. That being a shalom maker, being a reconciler, being someone who actively embodies this love of God is a willingness to step outside of ourselves, to see our neighbors as our neighbors, as people made in the image of God, who by simple things like asking him how the day's going, asking what you might be able to do to love them, to serve them, that those simple things might be able to actually have a profound impact. So, that is the essence of what I wanted to share with you this morning. If I may, let me close our time here in prayer, and then I understand that we'll have sort of an open time of conversation right after.
Yeah.
So if you would, please, bow your heads with me, and let's close in prayer. Creator God, maker of the universe, thank you for this day, the chance to gather together in worship. Father, we pray that you would make us your children, that you would make us into shalom makers, that we would live into your mission, that the Missio Dei would be our mission too, that you would give us a sensitivity, an openness, an interruptibility to respond to the people who are around us, that we would, like the Samaritan, be willing to open our eyes and not be intentionally blind, that you would soften our hearts, that you would open our eyes, that you would unstop our ears, that you would bring life in us and through us, and that we may, by your grace, live lives worthy of the gospel, live lives worthy of the name Christian. May your kingdom come. May your shalom come on earth as it is in heaven. In your name we pray. Amen. Thanks very much.